the idea that the United States is a country of religious maniacs. It really is a myth. I mean, I think it's something that is assiduously cultivated by religious interests, and politicians play up to it.
That is the world's most famous atheist, biologist Richard Dawkins. His book, The God Delusion, has sold millions of copies, and he routinely draws hundreds or even thousands of people to his public lectures. In the roiling debate between science and religion, he is religion's chief prosecutor, Darwin's Rottweiler, as one magazine called him. Richard Dawkins recently stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson.
You clearly have plenty of supporters, and you also, of course, have critics. The charge they typically make is that you are as intolerant as the religious fundamentalists you criticize, and they say you pick out the worst aspects of religion, especially the violence and intolerance that certainly is very evident in a lot of religious texts, and you pass these off as the essence of religion, and you don't focus on the more positive messages of religion, love, justice, compassion.
How do religious people decide which bits of the Bible to pick out? I mean, obviously, love, compassion, tolerance, these are all virtues that we all share, and we all try to live up to those. We do it whether we're religious or not. What can it possibly add to your love and compassion and tolerance to say that you're, say, a Christian, when in order to do that you have had to go through the Bible and strike out the many, many, many verses that preach the opposite of love and tolerance and pick out the few that do preach love and tolerance? So if they can cherry-pick the Bible on the basis of the modern liberal consensus that we all share, whether we're religious or not, why bother with the Bible at all?
Let me take what I think is the traditional liberal religious response to what you're saying, and that's don't even try to read the Bible literally. Many early Christians didn't want to try to read the Bible literally either. You need to read the Bible more as allegory, and they would say that ultimately the understanding of God is beyond language. That's what the Bible is about. It's searching for some sort of truth, but it's not obvious. You can't take
So any... why bother with the Bible at all then? I mean, if you know which bits you're going to pick out as truth, and which bits you're going to say are just allegory, which bits are so horrible that you just cut them out, which is a lot, by the way. On what criterion do you decide which bits to throw out, which bits are allegory or what? The criterion by which you decide is the modern liberal decent consensus. Mm-hmm. Let's just go for the modern liberal decent consensus and leave the Bible out altogether. What's the point of dragging the Bible in?
Because there are many people who do believe in God and find inspiration in the Bible.
Well, what kind of an argument is that?
That's why they keep going back to the Bible, because...
Well, that's not my fault. That's their problem. I mean, I'm saying you cannot use the idea that you can find goodness in the Bible as a justification for the Bible, because you've already decided which bits of the Bible to decide are good on other criteria.
Well, let's talk about the figure of Jesus, the central figure for Christians today, who the vast majority of Christians would say is the great symbol and messenger of peace and tolerance and compassion for those in need.
Let's take the central message of the New Testament then. The central message of the New Testament is that we needed our sins redeeming, not our sins, Adam's sin, Adam's original sin, Adam whom we now know never existed. So because a man who never existed sinned, God sent his son to be tortured and die on behalf of Adam and on behalf of the rest of us. What a disgusting idea. What a truly revolting idea. And yet that is the central idea of the New Testament, that a man, Jesus, was punished for everybody else's sins, the most primitive blood sacrifice, the most primitive piece of scapegoating. And that's what we're supposed to regard as a decent moral doctrine.
But if you look at the passages describing what Jesus talked about, he certainly talked about caring for those people who'd been shunned by the rest of society. Isn't that a very worthy message?
Of course it is, but you've just ignored what I've said. I mean, he was a decent man. He said nice things. Lots of other people have said nice things. Socrates said good things. Buddha said good things. Lots of philosophers down the ages have said good things. Jesus was one of the people who said good things. But so what?
So from your perspective, you sort of can't get past the whole point of the resurrection. I mean, that's the thing that sticks in your craw.
Well, I didn't actually mention the resurrection.
Well, but I mean the point of Jesus dying for our sins.
I think that is a revolting idea. I don't think Jesus himself ever said it, by the way. I think it was an invention of St. Paul. Jesus probably, if he existed, was probably a rather good man, some kind of a wandering preacher who was way ahead of his time in terms of moral philosophy. However, we've moved on since then, and we don't actually need Jesus in order to get good morals, such as, well, going back to the Golden Rule, which is, of course, universal, do as you would be done by. Behave unto others as you would wish them to behave unto you. That piece of wisdom has cropped up in civilizations all over the world.
What do you make of the concept of sin?
I think it's one of the things that religious people get obsessed with. It nearly always means private sin rather than public. It nearly always means something like evil thoughts or sexual thoughts or deviant thoughts or thoughts that they disapprove of in their private morality. It rather seldom means actual crime. It rather seldom means stealing or killing or being unkind, being cruel. My view of what's right and wrong is largely based upon what hurts people or living things, sentient beings. So I want to minimize suffering and increase joy, increase happiness. And I'm not the slightest bit interested in private sin. I don't care if somebody has thoughts that are regarded by some priest as being evil.
Are you more sympathetic to some of the Eastern religious traditions? I'm thinking of Buddhism, for instance. I mean, the Dalai Lama has come out and talked about how happiness should be one of the purposes of human existence. And he downplays the whole notion of sin.
I think we're talking at cross purposes because I am in favor of goodness. And so if a religious leader preaches goodness, that's great. But what I'm against is the idea that you need a religion in order to be good. And therefore, if it happens to be true that the Dalai Lama preaches goodness, then bully for him. That's very nice. Lots of other people preach goodness. But you don't need religion in order to be good. So why say, well, which of these religions do you favour? Buddhism? Do you favour Hinduism? Do you favour Confucianism? And kind of look them over and say which one is most likely to lead to goodness. Why not just go straight for goodness and throw out the religion? We can do goodness. We don't need religion in order to be good.
I came across a book that has just come out by Chris Hedges, the former New York Times reporter, who the book is called I Don't Believe in Atheists. And I want to quote a passage from his book and get your reaction. He writes, "The question is not whether God exists. It is whether we contemplate or are utterly indifferent to the transcendent, that which cannot be measured or quantified, that which lies beyond the reach of rational deduction. We all encounter this aspect of existence in love, beauty, alienation, loneliness, suffering, good, evil, and the reality of death. These powerful, non-rational, super-real forces in human life are the domain of religion." What do you make of that assessment of religion?
Bull. I mean, let's go through that. Was the word transcendent? I've forgotten the
transcendent
word.
Transcendent was one of his words,
yes. Okay. Now, in science, there are plenty of things that we don't know. So that's the first thing to get out of the way. Science is not a kind of know-it-all. We've got it all taped. There are going to be, in the next few hundred years, new scientific discoveries, new scientific insights, new scientific ideas, theories, which will be mind-boggling. They will be beautiful, they'll be elegant, and I wish I could live long enough to see them. That's the first point. Now, he then went on to things like
alienation, suffering reality of death.
Okay. Now, that's a miscellaneous list of things. Love, emotion generally, subjectivity, these are, of course, not immediately understandable by science in detail. Just as when I look at a computer, I don't actually understand every detail of how it's doing what it is doing. That doesn't mean that anything mystical is going on. That passage you read to me is obscurantist rubbish because it implies that that which is complicated and therefore hard to understand is therefore in principle impossible to understand, which means there's got to be something supernatural going on.
I have a different interpretation. I think what Chris Hedges is getting at, and I think this view is shared by a lot of people with a religious or spiritual bent, is that a lot of the most important parts of reality are beyond the scope of science, and they would say of reason. And these people are not irrational, but they're saying there are lots of the most important parts of our existence that are really, you can't get at through rational deduction.
Well, let's say what that beyond the scope means. Beyond the scope in practice, certainly. If I want to interact with another person at an emotional level, if I want to read a poem, if I want to listen to a Schubert quartet and feel my own welling up of emotion, I do not analyze that in a scientific way. So to that extent, it's beyond the scope of science. But you haven't really said very much when you've said that, because that doesn't mean that it's supernatural. It just means that it's very, very complicated, and you wouldn't use scientific analysis, at least present-day scientific analysis, to attempt to understand that. It's a logical fallacy and a pernicious logical fallacy to say that because it's beyond the scope of science, therefore we've immediately jumped the gap to say that it's supernatural, because supernatural means nothing. It explains nothing. It's a cop-out.
Do you think science and religion are just fundamentally incompatible?
Incompatible could mean two different things. One thing it might mean is that they have no connection with each other. I think that religious claims are scientific claims, because religious claims, they often include, for example, miracles, mm-hmm. and resurrection and virgin birth and healing and God reading your thoughts and God listening to your prayers and things. All that is a claim about science. All that is claiming that something is happening in the real world. Maybe God intervenes to heal somebody of cancer. Maybe God intervenes to part the Red Sea, whatever it might be. That's got to be science, because it actually is interfering with the real world.
By the real world, you're talking about the physical world, the natural world.
What other world is there?
Well, that's a good question.
Okay.
I guess the other world would be the world of the mind.
Well, either Jesus had a father or he didn't. That's the real world. So you cannot get out of it by saying, oh, this is a purely spiritual thing. It's nothing to do with science. Of course it's to do with science. If Jesus is thought to have had no earthly father, then that is a scientific claim. So in that sense, religion and science are compatible, in the sense that when religion makes scientific claims, then it's science's business to evaluate those claims. So to that extent, they're compatible. There's another sense in which you might say science and religion are incompatible, which would be the sense in which you cannot be a decent scientist and be religious at the same time. And that, of course, is a separate question.
And you would say that you can be a good scientist and also be religious.
Clearly, the evidence of individuals is such that you can. I mean, there are some very highly regarded scientists who are religious, yes. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean I understand that, but they do exist.
Richard Dawkins, author of the best-selling book, The God Delusion.